Welcome to Covered, a conversation about books with the people who write them. I'm your host, Harry Marks, and today's guest is Aaron Mankey. Aaron is the author of the horror novels Indian Summer and Consumed, now available wherever fine digital books are sold. Aaron, welcome to the show.
Hey, Harry. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Why don't you tell us a little bit about Consumed, your latest novel?
So Consumed is like the novel before that, Indian Summer, set in my area of New England. I live in the historic North Shore of Boston area. It's full of a lot of history. I have the pleasure of living in what is once called Salem Village, which kind of harkens back to the 1692 Salem witch trials, now called Danvers, though. They've distanced themselves just a little bit from that. And the whole area is just full of lots of great story and texture. And so my novels kind of dip into that well, and Consumed is the story of a man from this area who breaks down in a small town in Rhode Island. He's off doing some research for a writing project of his own, and he walks into a town that's in the midst of something that just can't be explained. There's some killings, and there's some unexplained, there's some unanswered questions that the book deals with. So,
can you read a little from the book?
Yeah, certainly I can. So the main character is obviously not from town, but he meets pretty quickly a gentleman from town who's about his age, plays host to him while he's in town having his car fixed. And as questions start to come up about what is going on in town, one of the people that turns out to be very helpful to them is the friend, this host that is hosting the main character. It's kind of like an old non-related matriarch. He didn't have a grandmother growing up. This woman kind of filled the shoes of a grandmother. And so they go to chat with her. She lives in a nursing home by herself. She's kind of at the end of, you know, those phases of life where you've sold off everything and you're down to living in a small apartment in an assisted living facility. So one of the chapters just deals with her going through little bits of feeling of loss and reflecting on conversations that she's just had with the main character and this other man who's been part of her life for a long time. I don't know about you. I feel like when people write, they tend to dip into the familiar, you know, something, an experience that they've had. Maybe they re-describe it in a different way or from a different point of view. Observations that you've made.
So there are some authors who claim that they never put any piece of themselves into a book, and I don't buy that for a second.
No,
I
think
there's always a piece of you in a book. It might be someone's name, it might be a plot point, it could be a setting, but there's always a piece.
Yeah, I completely agree. It was a visit to my hometown maybe 3 years ago to see my mom's mom, my maternal grandmother, living in her last days. Alzheimer's had taken most of her, but she was living in, you know, one of those small assisted living places. And what was left in that apartment that she was living in were just like a small handful of what she had owned her whole life. It was just whatever could fit, whatever was practical, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And that's the inspiration that I kind of clung to when I was writing the scene about Dorothy, this elderly woman who lives in this home. She's in her right mind. She's been able to stay very healthy. But at some point in the story, she's reflecting on a very long wooden buffet that she has against one of the walls. And so I'll begin to read. The buffet that barely fit along the wall between her Eden kitchen and the living room always reminded her of her late husband, Robert. He had been a truck driver making the run between Providence and California, where he was originally from. In fact, they most likely never would have met had a coworker not taken sick and needed a substitute back in the spring of 1947. She thanked God for that stomach flu or whatever it had been. There's nothing like intestinal discomfort to bring a couple together.
You didn't always write horror. You started out writing epic fantasy. I remember one novel, the title escapes me, but I remember the trilogy that you had also written. And then you took them down when you published Indian Summer. So my question is twofold. Why the switch to horror, and why pull down those first novels?
Well, let me start with the last question first. So my first novel was one that I took, I would say, 5 or more years to write. I grew up a fantasy reader. So I grew up on Tolkien and Chronicles of Narnia by Lewis. And mm-hmm. And then whatever else I could find that fit that flavor, I was reading all through high school and into college. So, you know, it's what goes in comes out, you know, and so if you're reading garbage, garbage comes out. If you're reading fantasy, fantasy comes out. And so I started to want to create my own world. And I remember in my first year of college, talking with a friend about wanting to create my own fantasy world. I think at the time we had envisioned it to be some sort of an RPG, you know, but I didn't know what was going to happen with it. But I spent about 20 years working on the backstory, and then about 15 years into that building of the world, I started to write the story. And so it was my first book, and I don't know, the first time I went running, I didn't run very far, and my technique was bad, and I had shin splints, you know. So mm-hmm. I think this was a lot like that. I wrote a book. It was really, really long, probably because I didn't have any idea what I was doing with it, but it was 140,000 words long. And I thought it was great. I put it out there. You know, Amazon was making it possible for people to self-publish stuff. And so I don't know when that was, maybe 2011 or so, I put that book out. And, you know, there were some sales and such, but it wasn't very well reviewed. And looking back, it's just because it was a bad book. That's just the honest truth.
It takes a strong writer to admit that.
Well, you know, I run better now than I did a year ago. I think that people grow and they change and they learn. And it's unreasonable to expect that the way somebody writes when they're 35 is the way they're going to write when they're 40, especially if they keep at it and they keep reading, they keep trying and being open to criticism. So I took a few months where I actually wrote a novel shortly after putting that one out. It was just a small little fairy tale called Destiny. And that one I've left out and available in the stores because I really, really spent time on the writing of that. It was just a couple hundred pages long. It was one of those exercises in how much can I say with very few words. Mm-hmm. And it was, I don't know, for me, maybe one last chance to stay within the fantasy world. It's just kind of the prototypical fairy tale book. But that first novel had been intended to be the first of a trilogy. And when I realized that not only would I have to, at this stage, what is it, you know, January of 2015, I'd have to reread the book to know what it's about, you know, because it's that far long ago. Then I would have to make corrections to the first book and rewrite it. And then I would have to write the other two books. And I don't know that I'm at that place right now in my life where I want to spend the time doing that. So the horror genre, to answer your first question, to me, I try not to use the word horror a lot, but I understand what that is, and I understand that's what I write. To me, it's realistic stories told in our day, in our time, in places that we can be familiar with the gritty reality of life. And sometimes life is horrible. You know, sometimes the world is full of monsters. You know, they're not hairy and six-legged, but they're there. And so these attempts, you know, through Indian Summer and Consumed are me looking for that adventure in our own world instead of creating another world. And I think it's harder to do it that way. You know what I mean? It's easy to build your own world, create your own rules, and then tell your story in there and make it all work. But to work within our world is harder.
I don't know. Maybe it's because I'm not really a fantasy reader, but I feel mm-hmm. like creating a world and trying to keep track of everything. For example, seeing what George R. R. Martin does with Game of Thrones. I mean, keeping track mm-hmm. of all the names and all the deaths and all the realms and everything. It just seems completely overwhelming. To do something like that, than it would be to set a story in New York and follow a series of characters where you have established landmarks and maps and all that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Although, you know, the voice in the back of my head says that's what binders are for. You know?
Yeah.
I had many of those with this novel. If you're an organized person, and I think you can find a system that works for you. And remember that it always starts small, you know, that you're, well, I'm just going to come up with a map of the world, and now I'm going to name places. And well, I guess some places are in one country and some are in another, so I might have to create a history for each different country, and then it kind of organically grows from there. But you know, what I enjoy creating in these what some people call horror novels, I like to call them horror light because they're not overly gruesome. It's more about fear. You know, it's more about the unknown and what it might mean for us. And that's what I like to create.
Yeah, I think the definition of horror has changed over the years. I consider, and I'm sure a lot of people who've seen it consider the original Halloween to be one of the best horror movies. But if you watch the film, it's not a very gory movie. I mean, it's violent, but in terms of bloodshed and everything, it doesn't hold a candle to even what came several years later with The Nightmare on Elm Street. I mean, it's just
right
in terms of that. So I feel like the horror genre has shifted, and what we've got are truly scary novels, you know, fear-inducing novels or movies, and then you've got what can basically be considered torture porn. You know, let's see how much we can, how gruesome we can make this, and how much we can make the audience retch in their seats.
Yeah, yeah, that's exactly what it is. H.P. Lovecraft, who was from the Providence area, spent a lot of time traveling up in my area here at the neck of the woods. They actually call this area around Danvers Lovecraft Country. Because he created a series of fictional towns, much in the way that Stephen King does, and I do as well when I write my books. I don't always place them in real settings, but he created a bunch of little towns that are all centered around, like the this is called the Cape Ann area north of Boston, and a lot of it was set here. But he wrote a really long essay on supernatural horror. And one of the, I think it might even be the first line. I remember it saying something to the effect of the oldest and strongest emotion of mankind is fear. And that the oldest and strongest kind of fear is fear of the unknown. Like when you go to the gut base level of what fear is all about, it's about things that you can't see, things that you don't know. That's the unanswered questions.
Right. That's why we're afraid of the dark. We're not afraid of the dark. We're afraid of what we can't see in the dark.
Right. Exactly. What could be there? You don't know.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, when you create fictional towns for your novels, but are any of the buildings or any of the scenery or the roads, are those pulled from actual locations around you?
Yeah, sometimes. You know, the town that I live in, I modeled a lot, I modeled the town of Holsley, which is where the first novel I wrote in this genre, Indian Summer. It spends most of its time in Holsley. It's pretty much modeled after the town I live in, Danvers. You know, there isn't a mill building on the edge of the river, but there is a river. That mill building is in a different place. You know, you kind of combine those pieces together. You can frequently find, you know, an old shoe factory or a textile mill that's been left to ruin. And, they give off a great vibe. It's just beautiful stuff. And so, you know, you drive around this area and you pick up on things and file them away, and that's the luxury we have as writers, right? We get to toss all those pieces into a bucket in our head and mix them up and come up with something that's unique and yet still very familiar.
Absolutely. What's your research process like? Do you have a research process when you're building these novels?
Oh, man, I totally do. And I think I mentioned this on Twitter a few days ago. The research process is probably the most frustrating part of the whole process, only because I find so many neat things and I really, really want to share them with people. but I can't, you know, I don't want to spoil what's going to happen or what's the gimmick or the thing that you need to discover in the next book. And especially with my wife, who is one of my beta readers. So I don't talk to her about anything as I write the story. You know, I don't like verbally work through conflict or problems in the narrative with her. I just wait until it's all done and I hand her the book and I say, please read this and tell me what you think. So for me, it's finding a story that I think I can, that, you know, that has legs. I can really work with this. And then the internet's a wonderful thing. You know, you can get on Wikipedia and things like Google Maps. You know, doing in Consumed, one of the very first scenes, the main character is driving through, you know, a small road into an area where I have placed a fictional town, and the road is real. And I was able to go onto Google Maps, drop the little yellow guy onto the street to get the street view, and then walk down the road, you know, and view. Look at that beautiful stone wall right there. Wow, I haven't seen a lot of mailboxes. You know, oh, there's a huge open field right here surrounded by stone walls. You know, I'm able to go to places without going there. And I find that really satisfying. It makes me feel like I can bring just that one last little bit of realism to what I'm writing, to tell the truth, you know?
Right. Do you find since you've been writing that you're more attuned to different things going on around you than you would have been before?
I am. I'm going to assume that for you, it's the same way.
Everything's potential story fodder or character fodder or anything like that. Yeah.
You know what I've really become interested in is emotional responses that I have to very unusual circumstances. Like, you know, if you're going to sit down and write about a bad day at work and coming home, you know, you can wing that, you know, you've done that 100 times. So, you know, I've had a bad day at work. I'm going to come home and this is how I feel. And you can write that into a character, but you know, like having somebody nearly drive you off the road because they're breaking a traffic law and you're just trying to stay in your lane, and that physical reaction that you have of the heart beating and that anger and that almost that paranoia of looking around thinking, are they going to come back and yell at me? Are they going to hurt my car or whatever? Like, those things you can't make up. You have to, I have to take note of them in the moment. And, so that's, for me, that's what something like Evernote is for, where I'll just write out a feeling or a thought or an observation and stick it in there, because I might need to reread that and relive it in a sense later on for a story.
So this is a good segue into your process. What is your writing process like? Once you've got the research down, where do you go from there?
So I like to write out what I feel like could be a synopsis of the book. You know, maybe it doesn't have an ending revealed in the synopsis. So it could, you know, you could think of it as like back matter, the book blurb. But what I really like to do is write A to Z, you know, here in a paragraph. Here's what I want to happen in this book, what I want it to be about. And then I take that path and I say, well, what are, I don't know, 15 or 20 major events that have to happen to get me from point A to point B? And then I look at that list, and sometimes they aren't as major as they appeared at first. Sometimes they're good chapter material, sometimes they're not. So I have to do some editing and some culling there. But in the end, I'm left with 15 to 20 bullet points that become chapters. And if I have 15 scenes, then I can say, well, I have 15 chapters here. What do I need to happen in this chapter? And then I start to outline each individual bullet point, which sounds a little boring to somebody who likes to pants it. Mm-hmm. To me, like, I get to have this one or two afternoons where I sit down and I'm completely in the full narrative from beginning to end. I can see it all in my head. I can grasp it all, and I can look for conflicts, like, oh, I can't do that here because it has to happen here, you know, this character actually needs to be somebody different, or there needs to be a third character here. I can figure all those problems out in just a couple days, and then leave myself with some bare skeleton outlines for the whole book. And then when I finish a chapter, for the next 24 hours or so, I'm probably ruminating on my outline for the next chapter. And by the time I sit down to write that, I've figured out the small little details, and I move forward with that.
How close does the final book stick to the original outline, and how much does the outline change throughout the process?
I would say it's actually pretty close, maybe within 90%. I'm done, that outline looks like the final product.
Wow, that's good. I know several authors who they'll outline, and maybe halfway through the book they'll say, nope, it's going to take a different turn here.
Yeah, I don't like major turns mid writing. When I was writing Consumed, the book that I've released is the third version. I started what I thought was going to be the story in a completely different setting with different characters. And I wrote 15,000 words and said, nope, this actually isn't going to be what I thought it would be. Throw it away, start it over. And then try number two. I thought I was just going to tweak the last one and rewrite it. I got 15,000 words in, realized again, nope, this isn't going to work, and I had to trash that too. So I don't know, maybe I'm more of a cut and run kind of person, where if it's not going to work, I don't want to take the time to. It just seems like it's so much heavy lifting to go back and retool, you know, 5-6 chapters of content to fit a new end goal. I like to wipe the page clean and start over.
Today's episode is brought to you by Nocht Sound Engineering. Nocht helps you record, edit, and produce great podcasts, streamlining the process so you can deliver high-quality shows to your audience. Whether you just need to trim the ums and you knows, or you're looking to set up the perfect recording rig, Nocht has it all covered. Speaking of, Nocht makes every episode of this podcast sound terrific. Consider this more than just an advertisement, consider it an endorsement. So if you're looking to bring your podcast to the next level, contact Nocht Sound Engineering today at nochtsound.com. That's N-A-C-H-T sound.com. Nocht, more than a stack of tracks.
Don't you find that if you stick too heavily to an outline, that maybe, especially in the horror genre, or the horror light genre, where there are going to be twists and turns and jumps and scares, that you run the risk of not boring your audience, but maybe being a little too predictable?
There is that chance. What I like to do is outline just enough, you know, that I know the basic idea of what has to happen in this next chapter, but I don't know all the details. And I allow myself to be inspired sitting at a table writing, okay, in this moment, I feel like X needs to happen. Or the vehicle for making the main purpose of this chapter happen is completely unknown. And I, you know, sometimes I sit down and say, crap, what's it going to be? You know, or mm-hmm. I sit down and I'm completely convinced that I have the right answer and then I write it. But I try not to over outline because I think you can do that. I think, you know, plotters can over plot. I also think that pantsers can, I guess, over pants. that sounds awfully inappropriate. You know, that you shouldn't have, I don't think you should wing it 100%. You have to have some idea, you know, even if it's just in the back of your mind, you have an image of the final scene to guide you.
I agree. I think there definitely needs to be, at the very least, some semblance of an ending in place. Even if it changes by the end, you have some sort of goal you're reaching as opposed to just writing until you think it's done.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. I you know, for me, inspiration comes in images that I need to describe the story behind that image. So, you know, kind of holding that image in the back of my head is very helpful to me. I like word count. You know, I think you and I have had conversations about this before. I like to track my word count by day. Mm-hmm. I want to see, depending on where I wrote, how much better at production was I. Depending on what I drank, you know, does whiskey have a different effect on me than coffee? You know,
it's a good very question. Nerdy way to approach the process.
Sure, yeah, but you know, if I want to hack this, if I realize that the best place that I write is my kitchen table, mm-hmm. and the best beverage is a glass of whiskey, then by golly, every night I'm going to sit down at that table with a glass of whiskey and I'm going to crank out writing. Now, it could be superstitious. It might just, you know, I'm thinking back to Nomar Garciaparra when he played for the Red Sox. Would get up to the bat, the home plate to bat, and he would adjust both of his gloves like 1,000 times, just undo and then redo and undo and redo the Velcro over and over again. And he thought at some point that it helped him. I'm sure he thought at some point, oh, if I just get my gloves a little tighter, I'll have a better grip. My hand won't slip. I'll have a cleaner hit on the ball. But you know what? It just became a superstition for him. So maybe that's what it's going to be for me. But right now, I just like to see I'm making progress.
Now, once your book is done, well, once the draft is done and you pass it off, how many beta readers do you have look at it?
I have about, I think for Consumed, I had 3 beta readers.
Okay.
And these are people that are not only interested in the genre of the story, but they also have very unique skills. So when I think about my beta readers, I think of a spectrum running left to right. And on the left side are people who are obsessive about typos, twos, 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 that kind of thing. And then on the other end of the spectrum are people who they're really, really zoned into the story. What's working? What's not working? Did I really feel like connected to this character or not? So my beta readers this time around, I had one on each end of the spectrum and I had one in the middle, which worked out really well. Each of them gave me a list of typos. I really felt like the person who was the obsessive compulsive typo finder would find the ones that the others found, but they actually didn't, which was, I don't know if that says anything about what I've put out there. Maybe I need another editor in there, but it was a really good combination of beta readers. So I put it in their hands and then I take, that's like all the feedback. I, you know, small punctuation or grammatical corrections, yes, but also, you know, you did this thing with this character and I really don't think that I don't think you delivered on what you were trying to do. So, and I had to go back to the book and like rearrange some major scenes to fit that.
That's good that you have at least 3 people looking at it before you put it up for sale, or before you go to the next draft. How many drafts do you do usually?
I know that it's different from every author. I tend to do, those 2 drafts. My first drafts are really clean. I probably shouldn't, but I edit a little bit while I write. And, you know, some people say don't edit while you write because it'll throw you off. You'll lose your inspiration. But I have my outline right here. So I don't sweat it as much as other people do. So my first draft usually comes out really clean. And then I go through the edits and make adjustments to narrative and things like that. Maybe a little bit of story changing based on the beta readers. And then I've got like a finished second draft copy.
Okay. And then you put it up on Amazon. So you and I have taken different paths to publication. Mm-hmm. I'm in the process of querying my latest novel in hopes of getting an agent and then eventually a publisher. You've self-published. Why the choice to self-publish?
For me, it's more about control than anything. I wanted to control the way my covers looked. I wanted to control what changes I made to my plot and what changes I didn't make to my plot. I wanted to put all of the blame on me if I fail. There's just a lot of ownership elements to it for me. I know people who are published authors who run in that circle, and I don't know that it's if it's the path that would work for me. So for me, writing is, it's the hobby I have when I'm not doing the day job, and I don't want to do book tours to promote my book. I want it to be a hobby right now. So I'm able to let it be that a little bit more because it's under my control. It's not about the money. I mean, yeah, I make more percentage wise per sale than a published author does, but I'm certainly not selling the volume of copies that they would. So it can't be about the money.
That depends. There are plenty of published midlist authors who don't sell a whole lot compared to, the John Grishams or the Dan Browns or whoever. But at the same time, you're taking on a lot of risk because you're responsible for all of it. And that includes marketing. Mm-hmm. Even if you don't do book tours, there are many self-published authors who do blog tours or who get their books in front of reviewers online or for podcasts or anything like that. So, you need to promote yourself. And I know on Twitter you've said it's like one of your biggest weaknesses is promoting mm-hmm. yourself, talking about yourself, especially because your day job, you're a freelancer and you're a graphic designer. You're a very good graphic designer as well.
And thanks.
Absolutely. And you design your covers. So there's that dichotomy between promoting what you do for a living right now and then what you're doing as your hobby and making sure you don't blend those worlds too much to alienate one or the other side. What's that struggle like?
It's not fun. I'll tell you that. I mean, I've never been able to find this quote, but I think I remember somewhere that Steve Jobs once said that marketing works on a debit and credit system, and that you have to earn credit to go into your bank account by doing things for the people that you're going to speak to, so that someday when you have something to sell, you can withdraw from that account to pay for that. So credibility to some extent fits into that model. Mm-hmm. But I also I just also have in the back of my mind all the time, like what pays the bills for me is designing logos and book covers for people. So I don't want to tire out the people who listen to me on Twitter by constantly talking about my book, so that when it comes time for me to mention my actual business services, that they've zoned out or they've muted me or whatever it might be, or unfollowed me. I don't want to frighten people away that could end up being clients and partner with me to work together on things. So it's tough. It's a balancing act. But I'm learning. I'm still, one of my goals for this year, I'm not a huge New Year's resolutions kind of guy, but one of my goals this year is to just get better at marketing my stuff. The other thing that I've realized is that the best way to increase the sales of your books, if you self-publish, is to just write more books. The more titles on a shelf, there's kind of a halo effect that takes place where, as an example, I'll give you a little view into the back room of my shop here. I sold one copy of one book in November. Indian Summer, which I released in February, I sold one copy of in November. It was my worst month ever, but I sold one copy. In the week that the first 7 days of launching Consumed, I sold 10 copies of Indian Summer. So, there's something going on there where people discover, oh, Aaron's got a book out. Oh, look at this. He had one out in February too. Well, I'll buy that one too. So there's a little bit of a halo effect going on.
It's like you're in my mind because you've touched on the topic I was about to get into, which is something that many self-publishers run into is if you're not constantly turning out books, then you're going to be forgotten or ignored. And so you get some authors who churn out a book every 2 weeks, every month, every 2 months. And I know on Twitter you've said that you've already started writing this book, but you want to try to get it where you can publish a book every several months, maybe 2 or 3 months. Mm-hmm. Is that still the plan? And Are you worried of running yourself too thin, of decreasing the quality of the books you put out?
I let the books drive me. So I don't know that at this point I'm worried. If I start to force it, I would hope I would realize I'm forcing it. But at this point, you know, if I don't feel like writing, I just don't write. These people, I mean, they're crazy, aren't they? Writing thousands of words a day just to keep up with this breakneck pace. And for some of them, it's working really well. You know, they've got 12 novels out this year. And so this is the way that I've heard it described, is when you walk into a Barnes & Noble, there's so many books. You can't just start browsing and expect to find something that you'll like.
Right.
So you start to filter what you see through a series of criteria. You know, you might say, I'm going to go to that section of the store that I know I like. In general, I like to read. So you'll go to fantasy or thrillers or whatever it might be.
Right.
And so you go there. Now you've narrowed it down, but there's still, you know, like literary fiction. There's thousands in the Barnes & Noble, and they all look great. You know, well, the covers are beautiful. And
it's all under fiction and literature. So you've got, you know, the mysteries are spaced out, the romance novels are spaced out, the genres are separate, but mm-hmm. fiction and literature, you could have F. Scott Fitzgerald with Thomas Pynchon, and, you know, you've got all of this stuff together. So, yeah, exactly. You've got thousands of titles to peruse, and there's no way to filter that down.
No, no. So what people do then is they reference a shelf that they have inside of their brain that has all of their favorite writers on it, as well as maybe like standalone books that they really resonated with or want to reread, you know. So they'll walk in and they'll say, you know, I've read a lot of Stephen King. I wonder if he has anything new out right now, you know. And so they'll go look at his stuff on the shelf, and maybe they'll buy a back catalog book, or they'll buy his brand new release, whatever it is. But that's typically how people do it. They also do it on recommendation from friends or family. Like, you know, this was a great book. You should really read this.
Yes.
So my goal is just to get more and more books out on my digital shelf so that people who have read my books, you know, they'll always have something new to pick up and grab. And the hope is that every time a new one is released, I gain a few more brand new readers who say, oh, I like his stuff. Let me go back and read his old stuff, and then I'll keep my eye out for his new thing. So that there's always, there should be a growth to the curve instead of a straight line. And that's my hope. That's my goal.
So then is the end game you're looking for here the novels to usurp the graphic design work you're doing, and so you'll eventually live off the writing?
I would love that. And for me, it doesn't mean that I don't like graphic design. I think I'll always do design work. Right now, it's what I do 100%, and it pays the bills. And I love what I do. But, I mean, writing, if you know, if I had 20 novels out and together they were generating enough monthly sales to cover half of my needed income, then I could design half the amount of time I used to and devote more time to writing. But I can also devote more time to my family. And that's the thing that's super attractive to me. Mm-hmm. Watching my kids grow up, they're growing up way too quickly. And they're only 4 and 6, you know? So I would love to be able to pause more and take an afternoon off more and just hang out with them and talk with them and learn with them. I feel like that's the wealth that I want to attain if I can find a way for a back catalog of novels to be this passive source of income. To let me do that, then that would be the dream right there.
That does sound like the dream. That's the dream I hope for. I mean, I do well for my day job, but man, if I could make a living writing books, hell, if I could get one book published at this rate, I'd be happy.
Yeah, for sure.
Since this is the first episode of the new year, I think it'd be fun to go back and ask you, what did you read last year that you really liked?
Oh man, I keep on my desktop my reading list. And I'm ashamed to say that it is mostly Stephen King.
I wouldn't be ashamed. He's a great writer.
Well, he is a great writer. You know what? Here's the thing. I grew up in a very conservative religious household, and I was always steered away from Stephen King. He's a horror writer. He writes about scary stuff. You're not supposed to read him. But what I realized is 95% of his novels are not horror. They're just showing you a very gritty and realistic view of life. It's, you know, it's not sugar-coated and polished up for a Hollywood movie. It's just like, this is the way it happens. You know, alcoholic husbands sometimes beat their wives, and like it happens. And so you'll find it in a story. And I don't know, to avoid that, I feel like you're avoiding all aspects of life. So, all that said, I read a lot of him. I will say, his book, 11/22/63. Unbelievable novel.
That has been on my to-read list for a while.
I whatever you can do to promote that up the chain. I mean, 11/22/63 was fantastic. It's at the very, very surface, a sci-fi tale of time travel, but that's 1%. The rest of it is just the pure joy of following characters across years of story. And his newest one, Revival, does almost the same thing. It's not a time travel story. But it is like 5 decades of being with characters and living in their heads, and it's fantastic. Andy Weir's The Martian, one of my favorite reads of 2014.
Also on my to read list.
Oh, you haven't read that yet.
It's sitting on my shelf, and okay. I keep looking at the spine, and I'm like, this is the day I'm going to pick it up and read it, and I still haven't gotten to it.
It's so good. And I did the audiobook. I do a lot of books audiobook, to be honest with you. I can do short fiction, like collections of short stories and things like that. I can do digital. I read a lot on my Kindle. But audiobook I can do while I run, while I do housework, you know, things like that. So the audiobook was really well produced, and it was hilarious. Like, the book has just got so much humor in it too, so it's great. And The Martian was self-published. Did you know that?
I did not know that.
Yeah, I think he self-published it himself and then got picked up. And, you know, he's one of those stereotypical success stories, going to be mm-hmm. a movie now, that kind of thing. So you have
something to strive for.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. those were probably the two best books I read in 2014. That said, 2015 for me is going to be a year of variety and exploring new authors. I've been marking down a lot of titles that you recommend, sticking them in my wish list, and you know, I'm wanting to branch out and read some more. The trouble is, you have to balance a lot of like your mental energy when you're writing, and I feel like I have to read something in the same genre I'm writing, because I don't want to throw myself completely off. I don't know what would happen if I was writing a horror novel and reading like a romance novel or something.
I did that while I was writing the last book and then starting the podcast. Because I was interviewing different guests of different genres, I was reading romance novels. I was reading horror novels. So yeah, you can run the risk of altering your voice temporarily, or, you know, you find yourself throwing in certain phrases or even pacing a different way. But for the most part, I found that branching out from the fiction I was reading originally, which is mainly commercial and literary fiction, so The Goldfinch or Gone Girl or mm-hmm. Dark Places, anything, you know, Gillian Flynn, I was glad I branched out from that, from reading just in my genre, because it was eye-opening to see the way other people wrote, the way other genres are written. It's definitely worth doing.
Did you feel like it benefit carried over into the project you were working on?
Yeah, I would say so. Because what happened was, I found, so for example, when I was really into the last book, I was in the middle of The Goldfinch, and mm-hmm. I found Donna Tartt's writing influencing my writing. So I had to go back, and I was like, I cannot sound like her. It has to be my book. So yeah, I run this risk of morphing into the author I'm reading. But at the same time, I was picking up ways of telling a story that I hadn't found in other books. Mm-hmm. You know, she's a great writer, but she's very redundant in some spots. But sometimes that redundancy is necessary, because mm-hmm. you want to drive that certain point home, or you really want to pop that image in someone's mind. And then the same way, you know, if you're going to write a love scene, well, you can't get any better than reading a romance novel. You know, you want to know how those two people play off of each other. So by branching out genres like that, it was an educational experience.
Nice. Well, I'm hoping that I get some of those same benefits this year.
You're very big on relationships and books, and I would say if you're gonna read a book to help you with that, Station 11 by Emily St. John Mandel is fantastic.
Yeah, that's on my short list right now too.
Yeah, that was unbelievable.
Now that's a character study veiled in sci-fi, right? Isn't that pretty much?
Yeah, it's dystopian fiction written as, and I haven't read The Martian, but from what I remember discussed on the podcast Books on the Nightstand, The Martian's very much like, it's almost like Castaway on Mars. It's very character driven. Station 11 is the same way. It's not so much about, it is about the aftermath, but it's more about how people are dealing with each other and handling the aftermath of this. Basically what happens is a disease breaks out and kills most of the population. And so this is, what's left are several hundred survivors across the country that are coming together in various ways. But the way they play off of each other, the way they've changed from before the outbreak, because it bounces time periods before the outbreak to after the outbreak. It's very, very interesting the way she handled that.
Well, I'm certainly interested. Yeah, it's on my short list.
So where can people find you online?
Best place would be aaronmahnke.com. AaronMahnke. Twitter is AmahNke. So just my first initial and last name.
This has been Covered with Aaron Mahnke, author of Consumed, available now on Kindle and iBooks. Aaron, thanks again for coming on.
You're very welcome.
And don't forget, don't judge a book until it's covered.